We'll pick up the countdown shortly here in H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
All right, then. So the first thing you need to know is that there has been a last-minute change of plans. There will, in fact, be a table at the Worldcon, the World Science Fiction Convention, which will be the 15th through the 19th of December in Washington, D.C., where you will be able to come by and see my exhibits and talk to me. I got notified of this about noon on Thursday. I was actually, I had assumed that they were just, decided not to do anything with me, and that's why I didn't hear from them. Apparently, that was not the explanation. I'm not sure I want to know the actual explanation. It's funny because, of course, it means I have to change all of my plans at the last minute, which I'm not great at. I was just getting used to the idea of, for the first time in a decade, having a Worldcon where I was basically free to wander around and poke my nose in on things, as opposed to one where I'm, an exhibit. But, I'm not going to complain. This is what I signed up for, obviously. I just wish there were two of me sometimes, although frankly, just so we could take turns. Of course, I would much rather I would much rather that there be other people helping me do the things I do, because I think they are important. I have a friend who says that she finds my show very depressing because I get on and I talk about solutions for the problems of the world and better things people could be doing than the things they're doing today and the possibilities and hope for humanity. And then she goes out, and she doesn't see anybody else talking like this, much less putting it into practice. Yet she just finds it very depressing that we don't already have lunar settlements and a scientific research outpost on Mars and the first O'Neill colonies. And I understand where she's coming from. And I guess my response is, if that makes you depressed, well, think how I feel. I feel like I have something of value to share with the world, but the world pretty much says thanks, but no thanks. Anyway, I'm going to be very, very busy the next couple of days, obviously, getting my laundry done, doing trial packing and repacking, figuring out what I can take in the form of an exhibit. I've been told I should be able to have electricity, and that's good because it makes things easier. I don't think I'm going to be able to take one of my black lights, though. I've got a couple of old just fluorescent desk lamps, one-tube fluorescent desk lamps, which I've put black light tubes in, which are great for showing off uranium glass in a darkened environment, but I don't want to try and pack one of those into my baggage. They're really quite awkward in shape. I do, however, have a really large it's like a pocket tube type black light, except much larger. It's like a D-cell battery flashlight type of arrangement with a fluorescent tube along one side, except the fluorescent tube is a black light tube. Anyway, if you ever wonder, why I'm saying black light rather than UV light, well, the answer is, of course, that I'm talking about a bulb or lamp which has an envelope made of woods glass, which is in the industry called BLB for black light blue. That's the code that will be appended you know, it's F15T8BLB or what have you. You get a lot of UV lights today that are LED-based, and the LED does not have the same envelope. This is important because, so in a mercury vapor lamp, right, mercury vapor emits a whole bunch of different spectral lines, and the BLB envelope screens out pretty much all the visible light, and also pretty much all of the far infrared, the UVB and UVC, which is damaging to the eyes and the skin and that kind of thing. So you can safely be in a room which is illuminated by BLB lamps, at least for a while. I wouldn't recommend doing it long term, but it's not going to cause you to get sunburn. It's not going to cause your eyes to blister, your corneas of your eyes to blister, the way that will happen if you get mercury vapor lamps with a clear quartz envelope. There have been a few incidents where there have been, you know, some party planner or something has set up a festival or a rave or something and used these quartz envelope bulbs which pass the full spectrum, and it's resulted in thousands of people being injured. See, comment here, Tobe wants a uranium glass lens. Well, I don't know about uranium glass. I mean, it's greenish. It's not commonly used for optics, but thoriated glass lenses were very common at one time, and I still need to get one of those because, you see, you can basically, thoriated glass allows you to increase the refractive index without a lot of chromatic dispersion. The only problem is, really, that because the thorium decay chain is much shorter than the uranium decay chain, that it builds up radioactive daughter products fairly rapidly, which makes it easy to find these lenses in an antique shop or a camera shop if you have a Geiger counter, but it also has the result of causing the lens to fog and turn brown over the course of 50 years or so, which is about how long it's been since lenses like this were manufactured. Anyway, the one good piece of news about that is that, as is usual, for example, with glass or jewels that have been turned funny colors by exposure to radiation, typically electron beams, which knock, or gamma rays will do the same thing, they knock electrons out of place in the crystal lattice or in the glass, and that causes a strange coloration, an unnatural coloration. Well, moderate heating, much lower temperature than would soften the glass. Moderate heating will allow the electrons to diffuse back to their original positions, and that means that the thing returns to its original color or clarity. So, I mean, this sometimes catches people who say, oh, wow, this is a really amazing gemstone, and then either heat or exposure to strong ultraviolet radiation, interestingly, over a period of time, will cause the electrons to drift back into their original positions, and the funny color goes away. Apparently, if you look on eBay, there are articles, because there are these, eBay, in addition to selling things, there are articles that people post about collectibles and so on. There's a number of collectibles about glass and gemstones that have been irradiated, because apparently there are all kinds of scams that people try to run using these things. Anyway, but like I say, I don't think I'm going to take one of my blacklight lamps, but I think I will take the blacklight flashlight, simply because the exhibit hall that I'm likely to be in is probably going to be well lighted, and the uranium glass doesn't show up, the fluorescence of the uranium glass doesn't show up very well under those conditions. There's just too much ambient light to be able to see it well. So, between that and the awkwardness of trying to get one of these desk lamps into my baggage, I'm not going to bother. But I'll take the flashlight with me, and I also have a near ultraviolet laser pointer type of deal. So, weirdest thing, it came with an order of eyeglasses, so that you could show off the UV-resistant coating or properties of the lenses, which, of course, are intended to protect your eyesight because, of course, ultraviolet and even strong blue-violet light can damage your eyesight permanently. And so they give you these protective coatings, which absorb the short wavelength, high-energy light and thus help to protect your eyesight, help to reduce your chances of, well, help to delay, really, the onset of cataracts, help to delay the onset of retinal degeneration. And if you're, you know, if you're really lucky, you know, you don't have to worry about that stuff. Let's see, Tobe suspects Cyplus part number 93996, and I'm almost absolutely certain that is exactly correct. I'm pretty sure that is where I got it, and that's almost certainly the thing. They call it, I think, black strap black light. But yeah, that's probably the exact thing. Anyway, so that gives you an idea of what I'm planning. Also, I did hear back from Dr. Kneef at Sandia with his address, so I can send him the nuclear reactor wall charts. I'm going to do that. That's going to have to be Monday. I've got a bunch of outgoing mail for Monday. And then first thing Tuesday morning, I got to get out to Love Field so I can get on the plane for a flight that leaves about 10:30 local time. Anyway, still, it's going to take me a while to get out to Love Field from the other side of the Metro Mass. But yeah, so if you happen to be located in the Washington, D.C. area, I think Guofu is back in at home in Ohio, so he's not going to be hanging around in Washington, D.C. But I think we've got a couple other members in that area. They may have day badges for the Worldcon this year. I don't know one way or the other. It will depend on whether it winds up hitting the attendance cap at the facility, which is fairly unlikely. That's all I can go by. Anyway, it looks like I am not going to have a chance to display the art prints, the 12 art prints that I bought that were put out by Interatom in the 70s, which is a pity, but it also means I don't have to figure out how to ship them or otherwise get them with me, which was going to be a real challenge. We'll see when I have a chance to display those, because that's what they're made for, is for displaying. That's what I got them for, is for displaying. Let's see. So, yeah, I will, however, I've got my portable DVD player, and you ask, why do I have a portable DVD player? What earthly good is that? Well, specifically in the instructions for the fan tables area, which is where I'm going to be, they said that we can display, we can run videos as long as we're not turning them on loudly and obnoxiously. I'll probably have a set of headphones for people who really want to listen. But the point, right, the point that I'm trying to get is that I have the, you can see on my TubeNext channel, I have videos that are transferred from film and videos that are transferred from VHS about nuclear energy. And since it's a nuclear energy exhibit, having the videos running on the portable DVD player at one end of the table would be good. And the portable DVD player, which I bought for $5 in an estate sale, if it gets broken or something, I'm not worried about it. That's the thing. If I were using my laptop to play videos, I'd be worried about it all the time. I'd be worried about people walking off with it. I'd be worried about getting damaged. By using the portable DVD player, I can leave the laptop in my hotel room and not have to worry about it getting, you know, that kind of problem. Anyway, so I think it's a real practical solution, even though it does mean, of course, that I'm limited to what I have on DVD, but you know, I can burn those. Matter of fact, I intend to make several extra copies of each disc so that if people say, oh, wow, that's really neat, oh, I want some of that, I can just hand them a disc. I mean, yes, I can also hand them a card and say, okay, well, you go to manatadam.info, and then you click the link for videos, and it'll take you right to it. Yes, okay, many people will probably prefer to do that, but this gives me a second option. I'm all about second options, or additional options. Options? Options are great. I want people to have options. That's one of the things I really believe in. I want this to be a world where people have choices and options. You know, the thing is, and I talk about this a lot, there's a phrase, you know, if you look at my Tumblr post, there's a tag I use frequently, and somebody actually contacted me about it the other day, said it was a real inspiration to him, but just the phrase, energy is the liberator, that energy is what has enabled us to break away from the slave and peasant and caste-based societies of the past in which you were born into the role that you would play for the rest of your life, except in very rare circumstances, in which you had no options. You know, you look at classical India with their caste system, you look at the American South with a slave system, they work basically the same. When you were born, whoever your parents were, whatever they did with their lives, that was what you were going to be doing with the rest of your life. You had no options. There were no alternatives. I believe in a world with alternatives. Now, some people want to go back, right? The anarcho-primitivists, for example, want to go back. And they say, well, let's dump agriculture. You know, not you know, ignoring the fact that all but 100 million humans would have to die for that to work. You know, they don't really seem to care about that very much. But they want to go back and they say, well, these the tribal societies that existed before the concept of land ownership, all that kind of thing. Those were the better societies. That's what you want to emulate. That's what you want to be part of. And those societies, I think, it's not generally understood. The limitation of a society like that is that there can be no freedom of thought. There can be no intellectual freedom in a society like that, because the one thing that exists in a society like that is social cohesion. Now, I'm an advocate of social cohesion, but I regard it as something that needs a certain flexibility. I don't believe that it's the only and the absolute good. And that's the thing, is that in one of these traditional, tradition-bound societies, social cohesion is the only thing. If you start thinking differently, that will destroy the society you live in. And so in self-defense, purely as a sort of immune, reflexive immune system response, they have to either kill you or cast you out. There's no compromise, right? In a traditional society, there is no freedom of thought. And that's terrifying to a person like me. See, Leon G. or Leong, I'm not sure which, in Com says, they say true democracy is a world where you can imagine any world and choose to live in it, and then anyone can choose to live in anyone else's world or create their own. It's an interesting thesis, to be sure. I'm not sure I would go quite that far, because it seems like some people it seems like some people can imagine pretty hellish worlds. And the thing that's always bothered me is that some people apparently choose to live in hell worlds. I mean, I think I've remarked before that if every Afghan with a gun, every Afghan with an AK-47 just went out and killed one Taliban, the Taliban would be over in 15 minutes. They don't do it. Why do they not do it? Well, they don't do it because they don't have any hope for anything better. The world they see around them, the world they've been living in, you know, their choices seem to be the Taliban or warlords, you know. They don't seem to have a path toward a world of liberty, or even a world in which they have the lights on consistently, a world of running water and flush toilets, which those of us in the wealthier countries tend to take for granted. They don't have a path toward that. And so what's in it for them if they revolt? Yeah, they don't want to be ground down in oppression. At least most of them don't. Most Afghans, I think, would say that they don't actually support the Taliban and their ideals. But they put up with it because it's not any worse than anything else they've had to live with, really. And there, I think, is the crux of our time. Right? There is the crux of our time. Hope. There's this concept I keep coming back to. Somebody challenged me on SDF Mastodon the other day. Basically, well, he was saying, you know, well, we have to do something about all this blockchain because it's burning up a lot of energy and doesn't do anything useful for anybody, which I'm pretty much in sympathy with. But then he says, and I guess we ought to shut down space tourism as well, to which my immediate response was, well, let's do a little quantitative reasoning. Let's do a little quantitative reasoning. And so I figure out, okay, well, here's the amount of oil that the U.S. consumes in an average day, according to the Energy Information Agency, which I keep remarking is not to be confused with a bunch of other very similar-sounding agencies. And here's the mass of a Falcon 9. So even if the Falcon 9 were all oil, which it isn't, a Falcon 9 launch would be 1/5,000th of the total U.S. daily oil consumption. In other words, realistically, since the Falcon 9 is about 1/3 oil, not entirely oil, then the story is that, yeah, you're down in the fifth decimal place of U.S. fossil fuel, of U.S. oil consumption, which means you're basically in the, you know, you're further down than that in U.S. fossil fuel consumption. You know, and so I don't see, you know, and since a Falcon 9 launch every day is not anything like what we're looking at in terms of space tourism today, I don't see that that's a realistic concern to be having as far as use of fossil fuels, which I agree we should probably be curtailing as much as possible. But again, you know, aviation bunkers are less than 5% of world fuel consumption, and space is a tiny fraction of that. So let's work on things like coal first, which is really easy to replace. Now, here's the thing. He had a bunch of other arguments, you know, basically saying things like, well, if billionaires are looking at the stars, then who's going to bother to conserve energy? Well, I think that raises a very good question, actually. If you say, why conserve energy? There's no moral argument for conserving energy, right? I mean, you can conserve energy by dumping raw sewage instead of treating it. You can conserve energy by doing a lot of awful things. You can conserve energy by having people pick crops and plant crops, people wash dishes, and by that I mostly mean historically women, wash dishes and wash clothing. You can conserve energy by subjecting people to a life of ignorance, brutality, and degradation. I don't think it's worth it. In fact, I think quite the opposite. But here's the thing that I think is really important. It's not just billionaires looking at the stars. It's all of us. Let me get back to what I said about hope, right? So the 20th century was racked with horribly destructive wars. And to a great extent, one of the driving factors behind those wars was fear of shortages, fear of lack. One of the strangest people I've ever met sat down and talked to me for a while once about the origins of war in hunter-gatherer societies. Because it's very odd that people like to naively associate warfare with organized agricultural societies, but we see it in hunter-gatherer societies. Why? Well, it looks like the basic explanation is that in hunter-gatherer societies, there's very little control over how much food supply you have. And so if there are two groups of people living in an area and they're both starving, if one of them decides to fight the other, then a bunch of them would get killed, at which point there's more, you know, the amount of food has to be divided among fewer people, and the group is more likely, the resulting groups or group, if one of them conquers and assimilates the other, is more likely to survive. And so that sort of thinking gets perpetuated. this is not biological evolution. It's, in a sense, behavioral evolution. And very disturbing it is, too. But the point is that if this is indeed how warfare developed as a human behavior, then warfare becomes more common when people feel threatened, when people feel insecure, when people believe that they're going to be short of something valuable, short of something they need. And sometimes that's something intangible, but often it's something tangible. Again, the only time nuclear weapons have actually been used in warfare was in a war which started because the country of Japan needed oil. The United States, the world's largest exporter of oil, declared an oil embargo on them. The Japanese decided that in order for their national survival, they had to seize the oil fields of the Dutch East Indies by force. And in order to do that, they had to neutralize the American, Asiatic, and Pacific fleets. Not exactly a good outcome. Indeed, if you read Hitler's table talks, which I really don't recommend, okay, but I happened to be passing by a volume of them in a bookstore once, opened them up and just flipped open, and here was Hitler basically explaining his whole rationale was that the area between the Atlantic and the Urals had to be cleared of non-Germans because in a few hundred years the coal fields would run out and then it would be necessary to depend on biofuels, which meant that you'd need 10 times as much land area per person. And the result was, you know, since only the Germans have a right to survive, we just got to get rid of everybody else. So here's my point. An animal caught in a trap will gnaw its own leg off in order to escape, in an attempt to escape. In fact, human beings have been known to do that. There was a movie a few years ago, I guess, about a guy who was mountain climbing and got stuck in a crevasse or something and cut his own leg off with a pocket knife so he could escape. The thing is, I see wars and other kinds of destructive behavior, right? The disintegration of social cohesion, the kind that we have to worry about, not the kind caused by novel thoughts, but the kind caused by people with knives at each other's throats, right? I see this in the world around us. I see this in the inability of people to come together to deal with longer-term problems like climate change, shorter-term problems like the coronavirus pandemic. And I wonder, why is this happening? And I believe that to a great extent what we are seeing is the reactions of gnawing your leg off because you feel you're caught in a trap. In other words, what the world needs right now most is hope. What the world needs right now most is confidence that there is a way out, not a way back in, not a, oh, well, we're all going to use less, and we're going to conserve, and we're going to sit around quietly, and we're going to have fewer kids, and we're just going to adapt ourselves to circumstances. Because too many people interpret that as being caught in a trap. Some people, right? Some people feel that that's great. And I'm not going to say that they shouldn't, but I think we can see, again, I keep harping on this, India, for example, demanding to use more coal because they're more afraid of the consequences of not having fuel to burn in the near term than they are about the long-term consequences of climate change, right? Long-term consequences of burning that fuel, right? Okay, so that's the thing. If billionaires are looking at the stars, it's not just billionaires, it's all of us. That is the mindset that we need to cultivate. All right? That is the mindset that we need to cultivate. Space and nuclear energy mean a way out of the trap. You know, Bitcoin doesn't do that. Sorry, folks, at hope.com. Bitcoin doesn't do that. None of the rest of it does that. But maybe the Man and Atom Society can do that for you. Send your cards and letters to Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. And thank you to the SDF Public Access Unix System. 7, 6.